Donald on the Kitchen talks about food. Donald on the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio.
The Donald on the Kitchen show is sponsored in part by the Mucky Duck Pub, where pub means community. More information can be found at www.themuckyduckpub.com or from Marcus at telephone number 232-8888.
Welcome to the Donna Lana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisquintas.
We gather here once a week at these beautiful studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames to talk about food, farming advice, recipes, and opinions. Donna, we got some rain. We have been so dry.
Thank goodness.
Don't things just feel a little bit nice?
I think even the perennials, like the bigger shrubs and like my hydrangeas were half the size of normal this year. The blossoms are just knit. Meh. We're not dead, but boy, we are not happy.
Oh, what a dry, dry summer. And here we are coming into fall. The trees are just they're starting to color and fall all over the place. And it's turning into fall. Yes, it is. And summer came and went really quick. Iowa has some really good county fairs, and this is a Donald on the Kitchen news item. Tick-a-tick. We just wanted to do a little shout out to all those county fairs, and they usually have food events. They usually
contests and ribbons.
That's what a county fair is for. And I just want to mention, as part of this news item here, that the Clay County Fair, which is a real doozy, as a matter of fact. Clay County Fair.
What town is it in? Do we know?
I think Spencer. I'm not sure.
Okay.
It's west of Ames someplace. Okay. But anyway, they had this year a Jell-O salad contest. And how nice.
This year and for the last 50 years, probably.
Actually, they kind of brought it back. It had gone away.
Oh,
they were
kind of course of it
doing
went away, right.
A nostalgia thing. And they were pleased. They were pleased. People brought in their best. And I just want to read you the top five prize winners here because it'll kind of tickle your brain. Oh, yes, I used to eat a lot of Jell-O.
Okay, all right. So at least it's reached nostalgic status.
It is. And here are the 2021 Clay County Fair Culinary Department Jell-O Salad winners. Okay?
Da-da, da-da, da-da. Da-da.
Number one, the Imperial Shrimp Salad.
Lemon Jell-O hot
water. Okay, and it does have shrimp in it with whipped cream salad dressing and then some green pepper eggs and olives and twisted. Yeah.
And the kitchen sink. Okay.
With some nuts and onions. You can fluff it all up, serve it in a bowl. Yeah. Imperial Shrimp Salad from Pam Halverson of Peterson. First place winner.
Woo, must have been outrageous.
I don't know, maybe with some crackers it'd be pretty
good.
Well,
isn't that something?
There you go. Okay, second place. Ambrosia Fruit and Pineapple Salad. We remember.
A classic,
putting all kinds of stuff. This has coconut and pineapple chunks and grapes in it. And
all the expected things, right?
Next one, Carrot Cake Jell-O Salad in two layers. The top's got orange carrot juice and it starts out with unflavored to make the Jell-O stuff.
This is a real gelatin dessert. Not out of the box.
And then it's got carrot juice and cinnamon and carrots and pecans in the bottom there. So for there. Okay.
It does sound kind of interesting.
Yeah, there you go. Fourth place, orange Jell-O salad. That's pretty classic.
Does it have the mandarins from the can and the whole bit?
Orange Jell-O and mandarins from a can.
Yes.
It's a classic. And the fifth place winner, cucumber lime Jell-O salad. Cucumbers and some mayonnaise and Jell-O, lime Jell-O. There you go.
Well, they did their nostalgia thing.
Yeah, and we had all that kind of stuff happening here at Iowa Small County Fairs. That was from the Clay County Fair. Very good. So much of what we depend on depends on healthy farms. We all have to eat. Practical Farmers of Iowa is a farmer-led organization working to build a more vibrant and resilient Iowa. And they recently, well, recently this past year, there is a new film, a full-length production, PFI's full-length first production, first full-length production, which debuted during PFI's virtual annual conference in January. It tells the story of regenerative grazing and its promise for the Iowa landscape. Joining us here in the kitchen today is the producer of that film, Nick Odey.
Writer, director, producer. He's the communications director at PFI.
Nick. Welcome. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, you just did a kind of screenings in four different public places in Iowa, so you're kind of coming off of a blitz with some new audiences. And so I wonder, how was the film received in your public screenings?
Well, I think the one thing is that it really started some great conversation. So we screened the film in Clarinda down in southwest Iowa. And we had one in Charles City up in northeast Iowa, and then a couple around here, one in Ledges State Park and one down at Waterworks Park in Des Moines. And after the screenings, we had discussions with the audience and a couple of the farmers that were in the film. And it started a lot of good conversations about a lot of the issues raised in the film.
Well, and that was the point of making the film, right? So let's talk about,
right. This,
you know, you're not a filmmaker. You're Practical Farmers of Iowa communications director. So you wrote the script, you did the narration, you did the shooting, you did the editing. And Nick, I have to say, I think you did a beautiful job. The filming is beautiful. It shows lots and lots of beautiful, some aerial shots and then some other, you know, just beautiful shots of Iowa and the personal stories that you tell in it are very compelling. You have, what, five or six farmers more, maybe, telling about how they're using livestock on their farm. And then you talk about the other effects of why livestock farming is important. And it's beautiful. The whole thing is kind of egalic and very, you know, very high toned. I you kind of leave it feeling inspired. So, wowzers, bang up job. So talk about.
Well, thanks.
Go ahead.
I really appreciate that, and I will say I definitely led the production, but it was a pretty good sized team at PFI. We did it mainly within PFI staff, but it was a big team that contributed to the project. We had different staff members that helped do the interviews. We had a big team that gave feedback on what should go in and what shouldn't. Jason Tietrich in particular, our digital media coordinator, he's the talent behind all the drone footage and much of the rest of the footage.
Really, really good.
I don't know how to fly a drone, so
good.
Nick, you can't do everything. It really was a big team.
Yeah. Well, and you did a lot of the voiceover, and you covered a lot of material. I have to say.
What's in the film?
Tell us what's in the film.
What did you want the film to tell us about?
Well, I mean, I think the big picture, what we want the film to say, is that when people stop raising livestock, people start leaving the farm, and that's true of just rural areas in general. When they leave the farm, they tend to leave rural areas in general. And so I think that's the big picture takeaway, that livestock are really the lifeblood of rural communities. I think that's the big picture message, and that's something that one of our co-founders of PFI, Dick Thompson, has said for years and years and years that when livestock leave the farm, basically people follow, and that's when you start getting a lot of the problems that we have in rural areas. So that was the most important thing.
Explain why that premise is true, as you did in the film.
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things is Megan Filbert, our livestock program manager, is featured in the film. And one of the things that I think is really important to remember is that livestock are a 365-day-a-year job. I mean, you have to be there to take care of livestock.
Yep. Yep.
And because you're there and around the farm, you got to be around in your community. You can't go to, I mean, maybe now with Amazon you could get a lot of stuff shipped to your farm, but you can't drive an hour. I mean, you need to go down to your local hardware store. And so it just injects a lot more life into the community. Money, but also, I don't think it's necessarily just about money. It's about relationships. Like, you just work with way more people when you have livestock. And so it just builds that, all those community bonds that are what make the backbone of rural communities.
Well, yeah, because you usually need hired help, because it's much more labor intensive than just, you know, sitting on your tractor a few times a year to do the corn and the soybeans. It takes a very active kind of farming. You also talked a lot about, in the film, about how having livestock on the land is ecologically beneficial, how it actually preserves the soils on the farms. Explain that.
Yeah, so, I mean, the soils, particularly in Iowa, evolved as a result of livestock being part of the effort. So, you know, for thousands of years, indigenous people, basically managed bison herds to rotationally graze all of the plains. And so the bison herds moving around across the plains, eating the vegetation, depositing manure, that action was part of the things that, a big part of what built the soil of the Midwest in the first place.
Yes.
And there's a whole bunch of other factors.
The hoof action. So their
hooves are incorporating that plant material into the soil, and also just like them eating and pooping. Like, I mean, just that part of it just played such a huge role in building that deep soil. Now, there's a whole bunch of other the actual rocks underneath what the soil would have been were also very important. But livestock played a really huge role over the last few thousand years.
Well, certainly
in maintenance
of the.
Well, in interaction with all the plants, this concept of free range, we've invented it. No, that is not a new thing. Unfortunately, livestock on the land, there is a trend of livestock not on the land, livestock in confinements, and then moving the effluent, the manure out, it just isn't the same, is it?
Well, right. I mean, I think there's a couple things. One of the things is that when livestock are on fewer farms, regardless of how many there are, but when there's fewer farms that have livestock, that's just, there's fewer people that need to be involved in that management. I mean, you can manage much larger numbers of livestock with much fewer people when you mechanize and sort of like streamline and do all that stuff. So there's just like less people involved in that than there would be if there were more livestock out.
We are not talking about CAFOs are not livestock on the land. CAFOs are when you put the livestock, actually, you said this in the film, that we actually have as much livestock in Iowa as we used to. It's simply that it's all moved into confinement lots, either the big houses of pigs or the feeding lots. So it's not like we have less animals, but we have more animals on less land.
Yeah, that's right. I think if you look at the numbers, I think we have more, we definitely have more hogs, and I think we probably have more chickens, definitely more layers. I think cattle is probably pretty similar, but the configuration is what changes.
Mm-hmm.
And we have way more turkeys too. I mean, but the configuration is what changed. So they're just concentrated into fewer and fewer regions of the state and onto fewer and fewer farms. So those farms, sometimes are doing well and sometimes they're not. I mean, but then those regions are where that business takes place, as opposed to, you know, if you have smaller, you have less livestock, but they're on more farms, it's sort of just more distributed. And so that economic and social impact is more distributed across the whole state,
right,
as opposed to being
concentrated. So instead of concentration, we need to decentralize. Now, the interesting thing that I think most people can immediately grasp to help understand this issue is that when you concentrate the animals, the manure is concentrated. Now, concentrated manure is not a particularly good thing. It's smelly. It's, you know, it's just all the things you can imagine. Whereas,
well, let's just say it's too much of a good thing,
yeah,
Donna. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Whereas when it's decentralized and the cows are actually spreading their own manure on the land, then it is beneficial because it returns the nutrients to the soil and closes, you know, the nutrient cycle right there in place. The cow eats the grass, digests it, grows more meat on his body, and then defecates and returns things to the soil. So in that natural process, everybody benefits. But when we start crunching the numbers differently, then we end up with all the problems that we get from confined animal feeding operations, which is a big deal here in Iowa.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that's kind of important to think about too is that, like, in the film we saw sort of we saw farming across a spectrum of how they incorporate animals onto their landscape. So some of those farmers had feedlots, for sure, but those feedlots were part of an integrated system that also included pasture, also included small grains, also included cover crops. And, you know, it's really a matter of scale. I mean, in certain contexts, some, like, I think of it this way, like, if I have a few pigs or a few chickens, as opposed to letting my chickens run all over my whole little farmstead, if I have the chickens in one area, I can scrape that chicken pen, further compost the chicken mm-hmm. manure, and then put it specifically on my garden right where I need it, right? So I think there's, like, there are applications of this. It's all about scale. On a bigger scale is when we have
Right, but even in what you're
problems.
Describing, at least the manure does not have to leave the farm. Like, for example, I grew up in dairy farming families. And it was, you know, when people typically had 50 milking cows in a barn. And, you know, I can remember they put the cow in the stanchion. There was a little indentation in the concrete where the cow pooped. And at the end of the milking, all of that was scraped out and made into a pile. And lime was spread all over the barn. And then the pile of manure went into the manure spreader. And, you know, my uncle would drive out into the field with the manure spreader hooked to the tractor and spread the manure on the field. So, I mean, it didn't leave the farm and it wasn't in quantities that could not be used quite locally. That's a different story
right.
than what we're doing now. Way different.
Yeah, and
I think
go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's a difficult thing to be able to see the difference in, if you're not used to seeing different scales on a daily basis,
yeah.
right? Because that scale, I mean, if you use, for example, smell as an indicator, like,
and it's a good one,
stink. Like what you're talking about, Donna, like, that is going to smell bad when you're out applying it. But, like, on that scale, that provided for that family, the nutrient loops were generally closed.
And you know what? It didn't smell that bad.
Right.
I mean, it wasn't in a concentration where there's a lot of ammonia arising and the toxicity and and stuff like that, you know. Whereas if you're putting this manure in a lagoon, then you get a whole different thing, and you can make the whole neighborhood stink.
Yeah, here we come back to communities. What is your responsibility to your neighbor, to the groundwater, to the creek that's running through the community? And once you start kind of screwing things up, it snowballs or something like that. Yes, the idea of smell and burning things out, it's not good. It can't be all that good for the animals either. But it does cause all sorts of community and political problems too. Talking about the effect of large confinements on neighbors and on communities. You mentioned that's kind of what's left. People, their reaction is that they leave communities. And that's not a good thing. But it must be a good thing for the people investing in the hog confinements and the chicken confinements, but it is not a good thing for what they leave behind. It's a whole different way of dealing with the earth.
Another thing that you touched on, certainly most of the people, the farmers that you interviewed, were discussing, of course, one of the reasons they were bringing animals back was because it added another layer of income for farmers. And we forget, you know, that the kind of highest value product really coming off a farm is often animals, because they're, you know, meat is certainly more expensive than cornflakes. So a lot of the farmers you're talking about were doing this. They came back to look at ways to make farming profitable. I have to say, on the PFI listserv this week, one of the farmers that was in the film, Wendy Johnson, who's, I believe, also the president of the board, posted this question: what are we going to do about farmers not being able to earn enough strictly from farming to be able to quit their off-farm jobs? And somebody else wrote in, well, farmers have always had off-farm jobs. And I'm going, no, that's not true at all. None of my ancestors who farmed had off-farm jobs. Now, we all probably lived modestly, but we owned our land, and a family could have, a decent, comfortable, hardworking, but you could make a living off of a farm. Everyone in my family did until the 1980s, for example. So this is a question, and from your film, you kind of demonstrate that this is a way to also bring higher income back to farmers.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, as you mentioned, livestock adding a livestock enterprise to a farm, at least one where you're also producing the feed,
right?
You're just capturing more. You're just adding more value to the things that you already grow. So one of the, you know, Arlen Kaufman down in southern Iowa, he added a layer barn. It's a relatively large scale but free range layer barn. And one of the reasons he did that is that he grows a little bit of corn and soybeans and small grains, and he can process that feed on his farm and feed it to his chickens. And instead of getting a wholesale price for that, he gets to essentially purchase it at wholesale and then add it, you know, he gets that feed cheaper, and so that he can put it through those chickens and add a little value on both sides of the of his production process. And I think there's a lot of that going on these livestock farms.
Yes, we're going to come back and talk more about this. We're talking about the film Livestock on the Land with producer Nick Odie. This is KHOI. This is the Donalana Kitchen, tasty radio for the heart of Iowa. Thank you. Welcome back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. We're talking to Nick Oddi about the film Livestock on Land. When we talk about livestock, so many of us are not even connected. So many people want to be, oh, I don't want to think about animals at all. I want to be vegan the rest of my life. I can't deal with it. But yet, your idea of, or it mentions in the film, the idea of how livestock is part of the natural world. It's also part of a working farm. Wendell Berry talked about having eyes to the ground, which means people have to be there. People have to notice things. And it's a little hard to kind of get attached to your corn as it grows, you know? But if you have a flock of ducks, or if you have a goat in there, or a pig or a cow, there is a connection. You watch things live. You watch things grow. You assist probably in their demise, because like Donna talked about, they turn into meat. But learning to take care of animals somehow rounds us out. And I guess a non-farm analogy is so many of us have pets. And we learn so much from animals, and having animals on the ground is a good thing. On the other hand, doing it in a big scale is not so good.
It's a lot of work. I mean, just taking care of pets is a lot of work. It's kind of like taking care of children. So, Nick, why did Practical Farmers of Iowa make this film and put this much energy into doing this kind of messaging?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think we have been working on rotational grazing for a long time. Our members have been sharing information on how to do rotational grazing, which is sort of what we were talking about earlier, mimicking what the bison did over thousands of years to encourage grass growth and to build soil. And so
let's define rotational grazing. It's not just where you put the cows out to pasture. Talk about this in the film and show it. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah. So I think the way that a lot of grazing is done really throughout the world, but particularly in Iowa, is that you put cattle out and they're on a predefined area and they eat the grass down to the ground there. And then maybe you leave them on that area and feed them some kind of supplemental feed on that. But the grass gets really short in those cases. And you leave them in that same big broad area. And what rotational grazing does is you put animals in a specific area and then
a smaller
usually
area.
With electric fences. Mm-hmm. What's that?
A smaller area.
A smaller area, like maybe it's, depending on how many animals you have, it might be an acre or two. And then maybe every day, maybe every few days, maybe twice a day for the really intense people, they'll move the animals into the next paddock or next section of pasture that's ready. And they'll do that continuously throughout the year. And by the time you get back to the one you started at, it's lush growth. And so it's a way to sort of, one term that was used along to describe this is management intensive grazing. So you manage what those cows or sheep or whatever have access to, and so you can make sure that the grass growth is long enough at any given time, which allows there to be more grass total, but it also prevents the soil erosion because you're never letting the animals graze too much. So you're always making sure there's just the right amount for where they are. And so PFI members have been doing this for a long time. This was sort of the basis for the start of our livestock work really in the early 90s, where farmers were sharing information about how to do this rotational grazing. And so we've been going on and on about this. And then in the last maybe 5 to 10 years, it's become way more popular. And it's sort of been rebranded as regenerative grazing. Mm-hmm. Because I think people started talking about the ability of grazing to actually build soil. And store carbon. I think that's probably true in some situations. Mm-hmm. But I think The rotational grazing part of it is sort of the bread and butter and what we've always done for years. And so we originally set out to make a few videos sort of on a how-to level, how to do this rotational grazing. Videos on fencing and what happens for watering if you're only on a little area. Can they access water or not? That's another big issue. But just a lot of how-to videos. And I think we started to realize, A, there's already a lot of how-to videos out there, but also there's a broader movement around regenerative grazing and regenerative agriculture. And they talked a lot about soil. We heard people talking a lot about carbon, a lot about, you know,
cover
grazing,
crops,
good stuff. But the thing that it was really missing was, what does regenerative agriculture do for people? Because I think that, you know, that's the point of all this stuff, the climate work, the water work, the soil work. The point of it is primarily the people. I mean, I think, you know, there's those of us who would argue that wildlife and wildness has intrinsic value too. But the main reason we're doing all this stuff is for people, for making this a better place to live. And we really thought that a lot of the work that was being done around regenerative grazing kind of just missed that. Like, it was a big opportunity to tell some stories about what does this do for communities. And so that's how it sort of grew out of this project, to explain some of the more nuts and bolts into telling a little bit broader story and hopefully reaching some different audiences.
Well, you also talk about the issues of water quality in Iowa and how regenerative grazing affects that. And that is a big public message. So you want to explain where that comes into the film?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think a lot of people are probably aware of the controversy in Des Moines over the last, I mean, it's been going on for a long time, but really over the last 5 years, with the Des Moines Water Works, which is the utility that provides drinking water for the city of Des Moines. And they pull water in from the Raccoon and Des Moines rivers. And as with pretty much any utility in the United States that pulls drinking water from a surface water source, like the river's surface water, they have to treat that water to make sure it's safe for people to drink. And in Des Moines specifically, their most expensive contaminant in that is nitrate, which is the same compound that is important to grow plants. And so that's largely because the watershed of those rivers is largely agricultural. It's largely corn and soybean agriculture.
And it is essentially the runoff from over-fertilization of nitrogen, right?
It's not that. That's a common misconception that the main reason for the nitrate problem is related to over-fertilization. It's much more related to the lack of ground cover in the spring and the fall.
Oh, that's right. So tell that story, because it's in the film and it's a good one to understand.
Yeah, so I think it's fairly intuitive that you might think, okay, there's a lot of nitrate in the water. That must be because there's too much fertilizer. But in fact, it's much more to do with the fact that Iowa soils are very rich. They're high in organic matter, and those soils are alive. There's microbes that are constantly decomposing that organic matter, and one of the byproducts of that is nitrate. Now, we try to get our plants to take up as much of that nitrate as possible because that's what the plants need to grow. But the issue comes when we get rain in the spring or the fall, usually, and there's nothing growing on that landscape.
Oh, before the corn and soybeans are planted and after they're harvested.
That's right. Before they're planted and after they're harvested, rain filters through the soil, and that rain, I'm not going to get into the chemistry of it, but it basically picks up nitrate, and then that nitrate can wash away if there's no demand from plants going at that time.
So it goes right into the tiles and into the rivers. Yeah.
That's right. If there's not plants there to take it up, it can be lost. So there's a whole bunch of other ways that we can keep nitrate out of the surface water. Wetlands are one big way, saturated buffers. But growing more plants during that March and April window, and then during again in the fall, is the best systemic way to do that. In other words, if every farm in the state did that, if every farm in the state had cover crops growing during that time, or had pasture growing during that time, or had small grains growing during that time, the amount of nitrate in surface water would decrease drastically.
So by having animals on the land, you can use small grains that you're growing, like oats and rye, which we don't really have a lot of market for. But if you're growing it on your farm as a cover crop or a rotation that's not corn and soybeans, and you have animals that will eat those things, that makes the system work, right?
Right. Like, the water quality problem and really the soils, the issues related to soils are fundamentally about plants. They're not really about animals for the most part. It's just that animals can eat the products off of that land. Animals can eat grass. We can't eat grass. It's that it is a marketable way to use that land to derive an income from that land by putting more cover on it. But the water quality issues and the really the soil building issues, they are primarily about plants. It's just the animals facilitate it.
Well, like in the film, you talk about one of the farmers that plants just straight out rye for his cover crop, it goes in after the corn and soybeans, and it basically, if there's enough moisture and it's early enough, it will start to sprout, but it will stay over winter in the ground. So you've got your cover crop. It can be grazed. And didn't one of the farmers even like harvest some silage from rye and stuff like that? It makes more animal food that you then don't have to buy, while at the same time it is covering the ground, which is producing, you know, roots and more better holding the ground from erosion and stopping the nitrate leaching. So you got the win-win-win, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, people are using cover crops in all kinds of different ways to benefit their farms. I mean, like you said, some people are grazing them. The probably the newest thing that people are doing is trying to figure out how to use cover crops as a way to suppress weeds. So in the same way that we might use mulch in our gardens, farmers are like, well, can we keep growing this cover crop till it gets really big and then use it as a mulch? And so there's that side of it. And I think the other side of it is that in the spring and the fall, when it tends to be wetter here, if you have that cover crop, if you have that lawn on the ground, you can get into the field.
Oh, right. It's not as muddy.
And have it be full of mud.
Uh-huh. So here's one of my favorite farm tools. Tell us what a roller crimper is.
Oh, Donna, and your roller crimper.
I love roller crimpers.
Yeah, so one of the ways, so the way that most people terminate cover crops, most farmers on row crop operations terminate cover crops, is that on one of their passes that they would use to kill weeds with herbicides, they're just killing the cover crop instead of the weeds. And so then there's a mat of cover crops that lays down. But for organic farms, obviously that's not an option.
Right.
So they've developed this tool, which is a big rolling cylinder that's got
spikes on it,
edges on it, chevron edges, and you pull that thing behind a tractor, and what it does is snaps a standing cover crop, and it's got to be at the right height and right growth stage and everything. But it snaps that cover crop at the base, and it lays it all down in one direction, and it ends up, and it kills the cover crop if you do it right, and it lays down as a big mat.
So you got your mulch right there, right?
There you have your mulch. And actually with soybeans, people will do that crimping after the soybeans have come up, which seems counterintuitive. You'd think you'd kill the soybeans, but soybeans are pretty hardy, and so they lay that mulch down, the soybeans are already up, and you're good to go if it works. People are still really trying to – it's at the early stages. People are trying to figure out whether it's a viable option around here or not.
See, things like that are what makes farming fun.
It's kind of clever, isn't it?
Well, because you're talking to your neighbor about it. You're talking to your extension people about it. You're talking to PFI about it. And people learn a lot of things from each other, and it doesn't always have to be a a come in and just kind of mine the soil, mine the area.
Get as much as you can out of it and don't give anything back.
It is more about working with than working against nature. And it can be a lot more fun than some folks would have us believe, even when it's a lot of work.
Rewarding on many levels.
This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. You're listening to KHOI Community Radio. You can find out more about us at www.khoifm.org. We'll be back to talk with Nick a little later. Here's some tune. Welcome back to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking about farms, Iowa farms, Midwest farms, a lot of farms, and not all farms are huge. Some are smaller, and even the ones that are larger, they're trying different ways of working with the land as opposed to being a taker of products here. We're talking about the concept of regenerative agriculture with Nick Odie, and he produced, along with many of his fine cohorts, the Practical Farmers of Iowa first full-length production, a film, a lovely film, called Livestock on the Land.
So, Nick, this film it's a little more than an hour 15 or something like that. It's pretty extensive.
Have a bowl of popcorn.
A commitment, and it's so why are you finding that non-farming the audience might appreciate this film?
Well, I think it's probably a lot of the same reasons why just more and more people are interested in regenerative agriculture. I mean, you see people you see larger companies trying to get more involved on this. I think probably the most famous example is Patagonia, where they've really doubled down on their regenerative agriculture marketing and really it woven it into their company and stuff. And I think that's probably because it's not that people are more interested in nature and the environment than they have been in the past, because I think that there's always been a group of people that are interested. It's that they're getting a little bit more nuanced understanding of the role of agriculture. So I think that maybe, you know, a long time ago, maybe even when I kind of first started getting into sustainable agriculture, which wasn't that long ago, maybe 10 years ago, there's more and more of, you know what, the way to address environmental problems in agriculture is to become vegetarian or become vegan.
Yeah.
Right? Yep. And I think that's a very simple start
simplistic,
to thinking
perhaps,
about how these things get at, but it doesn't really reflect sort of the more nuanced understanding of how all these pieces fit together in the actual landscape that I think people are becoming more and more aware of.
So I also think that, I mean, probably this film is not going to make it big in Hollywood, but it really, really speaks to Iowans and basically Midwesterners to understand. I mean, you know, Lana and I, of course, we're obsessed with anything about food farming, food systems, you know, all of that sort of thing. But a lot of other people also want to know and understand how this works. And I feel like your film, yeah, probably some farmers are going to learn a few things from it too. But I think the general audience, especially people who live in Iowa and the surrounding Midwestern areas, can really be inspired by this. There's a lot of information in the film. It's very beautiful. It, you know, left me feeling very good about being an Iowan, as a matter of fact. You know, this is not, this may be flyover country, but you know what? They can just keep flying over because we're having a great time here. So, this film is available for free on YouTube. You want to explain how people can find it?
Yeah, people can just go to YouTube and search for Livestock on the Land, and they are going to find the film. In fact, if you just Google Livestock on the Land, you'll
it's
find
true.
It.
Last night when I was rewatching it, I just Googled Livestock on the Land PFI, and it popped right up. So it's really easy to find. And or you can go to the PFI website, too, and find it there if you forget, like, Lana was looking up animals on the land. No, it's called Livestock on the Land. And you can find it at the Practical Farmers of Iowa website. So it's been, I hope, well received. And are you going to do some more filming in the future?
We are certainly, so our next big project is to really dive into the more of the world of cover crops and small grains and what potential those different practices, in other words, growing cover crops in between corn and soybeans, and then also instead of corn and soybeans, once in a while growing things like small grains,
mm-hmm.
even though those seem like relatively small changes, the big potential that small change has to diversify the landscape and help mitigate the risk of the increasingly risky world that I think we're all coming to realize.
Right. It can bring more water retention in the soil, which is going to be good for a summer like we had this year where there's drought. Or if we get flooding, the soil will actually not wash away as much and hold more of the water when it does come. I mean, there are all kinds of reasons to make these changes away from, you know, we've had a 50-year experiment in, the Green Revolution here in Iowa. And some of it has been brilliant, but lots of it has left Iowa in particularly not great shape in terms of soil erosion and pollution. And so PFI is really making a huge effort to, amongst the farmers, you know, this is not something coming out of your land grant institutions. This is a farmer-driven, statewide and beyond organization that is doing a lot of work to give out information, to share information, to produce scientific. Mm-hmm. You do a lot of field trials. It's all farmer-driven. It's a remarkable organization and a great film. So
yeah, and talking about cover crops, even if you're not a farmer, well, I'm a farmer, so as I drive around the state, I'm looking at fields, I'm looking at what's going on. But notice where there's green coming up this time of year underneath newly harvested soybeans and corn. There are places, and you can see those little bursts of cover crop that are kind of taking us into winter. It's a lot. Those are the things that's different than it used to be.
But we need more.
Things used to be plowed under, and we would have bare soil all winter, and in the spring it would blow. There are different ways to do these things, and PFI is a good place to learn about this. Oh, Donna, you mentioned that this film might not be a big deal in Hollywood, but I think just adding maybe a tractor chase would help. You know, like a car chase. Put something in the middle there.
Or Nick, how about a dating game with the farmers? Oh. You know, that's been popular in the wider world or something.
Well, Nick, we are here to help. We are here to help.
Anyway, good job that you did. And we look forward to the next one. And Tell everybody again how they can find it, Nick.
You can just go to YouTube.com and search for Livestock on the Land, and it'll be the first thing that pops up.
Fantastic.
And we want to mention another film. We've talked about this before. Last year, also for the PFI conference, Lana and I did a short film on how to use the products of the cows and the sheep, the offal. So we made a video of cooking tongue and using bones. And what else did we do? Oh, liver pate. So that YouTube is also available if you want to learn how to cook some of the products of those livestock in your own kitchen with Lana and I. And you can find, I just Googled PFI Donna Lana Kitchen. And it came right up. So that's another little film that we want to offer to you from PFI and from Lana and I.
Great. So how was your garden this year, Nick?
Well, it was another pretty good tomato year. I grew a lot of tomatoes and peppers, but my wife Emily saved a few seeds from a very productive tomato crop last year and got some started that way, and in addition to some that we got from you. And it was another year. Just got done fermenting some peppers for hot peppers for hot sauce. So I just started to put the garden to bed, and I just have cover crops planted there, and they're just coming up now, I saw, with these last bits of rain.
Oh, good. What are you putting down in your garden space for a cover crop?
It's a mix of rye, hairy vetch, and clover, and hope is that for some of those ones like tomatoes where I might be able to get by not planting until June, that those legumes might fix a little bit of nitrogen in there. But I was really excited because this was the first year my compost pile was done, so I got to spread a layer of compost over the whole garden, which was pretty fun.
Oh, good. Oh, those small joys that gardeners have. Ah, I got to spread compost. Yes, that's the time of year. Yes, it is.
Well, and next is hunting season, Nick. So we've had Nick on about various kinds of hunting around the state and beyond. So I hope you'll come back and talk to us later about venison and ducks and all the good food that we can get from our natural resources.
Yeah, speaking of livestock on the land, we know it's a good idea because they're out there in the wild, and it works for them, and doggone it, it's nice to have livestock as part of your farm. It kind of makes everything come full circle. Thank you for being with us, Nick.
Thank you so much for having me on the show, and look forward to being back soon.
Great. Okey-doke.
Good. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We come to you Tuesdays at noon and repeat at 7 p.m. or anytime if you go to khoifm.org. And there's things that are streamed and you can download us and all that sort of stuff. Remember, still keep wearing your mask if it's appropriate. Be kind. Get your jab. Get your vaccination if you haven't yet. And remember, we're all in this together. Music today by David Cantini and his magic flute. We'll go out with a tune called Red Rock. Support this fine radio station. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We have excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.